But men were there. On the third deck aft, Coxswain James Forbes felt skinned alive, and the number 4 turret handling room was filled with thick smoke. He and his mates finally moved over to number 3 turret, where conditions were a little better, but soon smoke began coming in around the guns there, too. The men stripped to their skivvy drawers and crammed their clothes around the guns to keep the smoke out. When somebody finally ordered them out, Forbes took off his newly shined shoes and carefully carried them in his hands as he left the turret. The deck was blazing hot and covered with oil, but there was a dry spot farther aft near number 4 turret, and before rejoining the fight, Forbes carefully placed his shoes there. He lined them neatly with the heels against the turret, just as though he planned to wear them up Hotel Street again that night. In the portside anti-aircraft director, Russell Lott wrapped himself in a blanket and stumbled out the twisted door. The blanket kept him from getting scorched, but the deck was so hot he had to keep hopping from one foot to the other. 5 shipmates staggered up through the smoke, so he stretched the blanket as a sort of shield for them all. Then he saw the Vestal still alongside. The explosion had left her decks a shambles, but he found someone who tossed over a line, and one by one, all 6 men inched over to the little repair ship. At that particular moment, they were lucky to find anyone on the Vestal. The blast had blown some of the crew overboard, including Skipper Casson Young, and the executive officer told the rest to abandon ship. Seaman Thomas Garzioni climbed down a line over the forecastle, came to the end of it, and found himself standing on the anchor. He just froze there. He was a non-swimmer and too scared to jump the rest of the way. Finally, he worked up enough nerve, made the sign of the cross, and plunged down holding his nose. For a non-swimmer, he made remarkable time to a whaleboat drifting in the debris. Signalman Adolf Slabas dived off the bridge and reached a launch hovering nearby. He and a few others yelled encouragement to a young sailor who had climbed out on the Vestal's boat boom and now dangled from a rope ladder 5 feet above the water. Finally, the man let go, landed flat in the water with a resounding whack. The men in the launch couldn't help laughing. Still on board the Vestal, radioman John Murphy watched a long line of men pass his radio room on their way to abandon ship. One of the other radiomen saw his brother go by. He cried, "I'm going with him," and ran out the door. For no particular reason, Murphy decided to stay, but he began feeling that he would like to get back home just once more before he passed on. At this point, Commander Young climbed back on the Vestal from his swim in the harbor. He was by no means ready to call it a day. He stood sopping wet at the top of the gangway, shouting down to the swimmers and the men in the boats, "Come back! We're not giving up this ship yet." Most of the crew returned, and Young gave orders to cast off. Men hacked at the hawsers, tying the Vestal to the blazing Arizona. Inevitably, there was confusion. One officer on the Arizona's quarterdeck yelled, "Don't cut those lines!" Others on the battleship pitched in and helped. Aviation mechanic Turkey Graham slashed the last line with an axe, shouting, "Get away from here while you can!" Other help came from an unexpected source. A Navy tug happened by, whose skipper and chief engineer had both put in many years on the Vestal. They loyally eased alongside, took a line from the bow, and towed their old ship off toward Aiea Landing, where she could safely sit out the rest of the attack. When the Arizona blew up, Chief Electrician's Mate Harold North on the Maryland thought the end of the world had come. Actually, he was lucky. Moored inboard of the Oklahoma, the Maryland was safe from torpedoes and caught only 2 bombs. One was a 15-inch armor-piercing shell fitted with fins. It slanted down just off the port bow, smashing into her hull 17 feet below the waterline. The other hit the forecastle, setting the awnings on fire. When a strafer swept by, Chief George Hatel watched the firefighters scoot for shelter. One man threw his extinguisher down a hatch where it exploded at the feet of an old petty officer who grabbed for a mask, shouting, "Gas!" The Tennessee, the other inboard battleship, had more trouble. Seaman J.P. Burkholder looked out a porthole on the bridge just as one of the converted 16-inch shells crashed down on number 2 turret a few feet forward. The porthole cover tore loose, clobbered him on the head, and sent him scurrying through the door. Outside, he helped a wounded ensign, but couldn't help one of his closest friends, who was so far gone he only wanted Burkholder to shoot him. Another armor-piercing bomb burst through number 3 turret farther aft. Seaman S.F. Bowen, stationed there as a powder carman, was just dogging the hatch when the bomb hit. It wasn't a shattering crash at all. Just a ball of fire about the size of a basketball appeared overhead and seemed to melt down on everyone. It seemed to run down on his skin and there was no way to stop it. As he crawled down to the deck below, he noticed that his shoestrings were still on fire. Splinters flew in all directions from the bombs that hit the Tennessee. One hunk ripped the bridge of the West Virginia alongside, cut down Captain Mervyn Banion as he tried to direct his ship's defense. He slumped across the sill of the signal bridge door on the starboard side of the machine gun platform. Soon after he fell, Ensign Delano arrived on the bridge, having finally been sent up from Central Station. As Delano stepped out onto the platform, Lieutenant J.G. F.H. White rushed by, told him about the captain, and asked him to do what he could. Delano saw right away it was hopeless. Captain Banion had been hit in the stomach, and it took no medical training to know the wound was fatal. Yet he was perfectly conscious, and at least he might be made more comfortable. Delano opened a first aid kit and looked for some morphine. No luck. Then he found a can of ether and tried to make the captain pass out. He sat down beside the dying man, holding his head in one hand and the ether in the other. It made the captain drowsy, but never unconscious. Occasionally, Delano moved the captain's legs to more comfortable positions, but there was so little he could do. As they sat there together, Captain Banion prodded him with questions. He asked how the battle was going, what the West Virginia was doing, whether the ship and the men were badly hit. Delano did his best to answer, resorting every now and then to a gentle white lie. Yes, he assured the captain, the ship's guns were still firing. Lieutenant Ricketts now turned up and proved a pillar of strength. Other men arrived, too. Chief Pharmacist's Mate Leek, Ensign Jacoby from the flag radio room, Lieutenant Commander Dwyer Johnson from the forecastle. On his way up, Johnson ran across Big Doris Miller, thought the powerful mess steward might come in handy, brought him along to the bridge. Together, they tenderly lifted Captain Banion and carried him to a sheltered spot behind the conning tower. He was still quite conscious and well aware of the flames creeping closer. He kept telling the men to leave him and save themselves. In her house at Macalapa, Mrs. Mayfield still couldn't grasp what had happened. She walked numbly to a window and looked at Admiral Kimmel's house across the street. The Venetian blinds were closed, and there was no sign of activity. Somehow this was reassuring. Surely there would be some sign of life if it was really true. It didn't occur to her that this might be one morning when the Admiral had no time for Venetian blinds. By now, Captain Mayfield was in his uniform. He took a few swallows of coffee, slopping most of it on the saucer, and dashed for the carport. He roared off as the SyncPak official car screeched up to the Admiral's house across the street. Admiral Kimmel ran down the steps and jumped in, knotting his tie on the way. Captain Freeland Daubin, commanding a squadron of submarines, leaped on the running board as the car moved off, and Captain Earl's station wagon shot down the hill after them. In 5 minutes, Admiral Kimmel was at SyncPak headquarters in the sub-base. The Admiral thought he was there by 8:05. Commander Murphy thought it was more like 8:10. In either case, within a very few minutes of his arrival, the backbone of his fleet was gone or immobile. Arizona, Oklahoma, and West Virginia sunk, California sinking, Maryland and Tennessee bottled up by the wrecked battleships alongside, Pennsylvania squatting in dry dock. Only the Nevada was left, and she seemed a forlorn hope with one torpedo and two bombs already in her. Nor was the picture much brighter elsewhere. On the other side of Ford Island, the target ship Utah took a heavy list to port as her engineering officer, Lieutenant Commander S.S. Isquith, pulled his khakis over his pajamas. The alarm bell clanged a few strokes and stopped. The men trooped below to take shelter from bombing. Isquith sensed the ship couldn't last, and he had the officer of the deck order all hands topside instead. The men were amazingly cool, perhaps because they were used to being bombed by the Army and Navy every day. When Machinist's Mate David Gil Martin reached the main deck, he found the port rail already underwater. Twice he crawled up toward the starboard side and slid back. As he did it a third time, he slid by another seaman who suggested he throw away the cigarettes. To Gil Martin's amazement, he had been trying to climb up the slanting deck while holding a carton of cigarettes in one hand. Relieved of this handicap, he made the starboard rail easily. As the list increased, the big 6x12-inch timbers that covered the Utah's decks began breaking loose. These timbers were used to cushion the decks against practice bombing and undoubtedly helped fool the Japanese into thinking the ship was a carrier unexpectedly in port. Now they played another lethal role, sliding down on the men trying to climb up. As she rolled still further, Commander Isquith made a last check below to find anyone who might still be trapped, and almost got trapped himself. He managed to reach the captain's cabin, where a door led to the forecastle deck. The timbers had jammed the door, so he stumbled into the captain's bedroom where he knew there was a porthole. It was now almost directly overhead, but he managed to reach it by climbing on the captain's bed. As he popped his head through the porthole, The bed broke loose and slid out from under him.